from Pacifica, this is Democracy Now.
Several steps are to be taken, the first of which will be the declaration of a state of emergency after the necessary legal and constitutional procedures are complete for 3 months in Egypt.
Egyptian President al-Sisi declares a state of emergency after a pair of bombings targeting Coptic Christian churches on Palm Sunday kill 49 people, injuring over 100. We'll go to Cairo for the latest. Then we look at how Attorney General Jeff Sessions is seeking to limit federal oversight over troubled police departments and escalate the war on drugs.
Unfortunately, in recent years, law enforcement as a whole, I think, has been unfairly maligned and blamed for unacceptable deeds of a few bad actors.
Plus, as the Trump administration sends an aircraft carrier and several warships toward the Korean Peninsula and issues new warnings to Syria, we'll look at who profits when the U.S. goes to war. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's heading to Russia today, where he's meeting with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, and amid increasing tensions between the U.S. and Russia over the ongoing war in Syria. Russian President Vladimir Putin will not meet with Tillerson, a move that points to increasing conflict between the two countries following the U.S. decision to launch 59 missiles at a Syrian government airbase last week. The U.S. says strike was in retaliation for a chemical weapons attack allegedly carried out by the Syrian government, which killed 86 civilians, including dozens of children. On Monday, White House spokesman Sean Spicer signaled the U.S. may take further military action in Syria, not only in retaliation for chemical weapons attacks, but also to attacks like barrel bombs.
I think the president has been very clear that there are a number of lines that were crossed last week. I think what not just Syria, but the world saw last week is a president that is going to act decisively and proportionally and with justification when it comes to actions like that. I mean, and I will tell you, the answer is that if you gas a baby, if you put a barrel bomb in to innocent people, I think you can you will see a response from this president.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson spent Monday in Italy for the G7 meeting, where the foreign ministers discussed the ongoing Syrian war. Outside the meeting, demonstrators protesting the G7 were attacked by Italian police. This is one of the protesters, Marco Rizzo.
The people in Europe and the Middle East need to wake up and find a way to make their real enemies pay the price for what is being done. Our real enemies are the governments, the banks, the big multinational arms manufacturers who make profit with the blood of each one of us. This is the only solution there is. We think the only solution is not to expect anything more from these governments.
We'll have more on Syria, including how President Trump personally profited from the attack on the Syrian airbase with 59 Raytheon Tomahawk missiles later in the broadcast. Meanwhile, U.S.-led coalition airstrikes targeting ISIS militants in Syria's Raqqa government continue to kill civilians. The journalistic monitoring group Air Wars says on Friday, a U.S.-led coalition airstrike on a house reportedly killed at least 5 civilians, while another strike that same day on an internet cafe reportedly killed at least 9 civilians, including 3 children. The following day, a U.S.-led coalition airstrike reportedly killed at least 7 civilians, including 6 children, when the strike hit a boat on the Euphrates River the family was traveling on. And on Sunday, a U.S. strike on a market reportedly killed 3 civilians, a married couple and their son. North Korea is warning the United States it's ready for war following the Pentagon's decision to send an aircraft carrier known as the Carl Vinson and 3 guided missile destroyers and cruisers to the Korean Peninsula. A North Korean foreign ministry spokesman told the state-run news agency, quote, "We will hold the U.S. wholly accountable for the catastrophic consequences to be entailed by its outrageous actions. North Korea is ready to react to any mode of war desired by the U.S., unquote. In San Bernardino, California, residents gathered Monday night for a vigil to mourn the deaths of 8-year-old Jonathan Martinez and elementary school teacher Karen Elaine Smith, who were murdered Monday morning when Smith's estranged husband walked into her special education classroom at North Park Elementary School and began shooting at his wife with a high-caliber revolver. The man, Cedric Anderson, had a history of domestic violence. Karen Elaine Smith's mother says she was planning to divorce him at the time of the shooting. Anderson shot and killed himself in the classroom after murdering his wife, fatally wounding 8-year-old Martinez and injuring a 9-year-old student. This is San Bernardino Police Chief Jared Burguan.
Cedric entered the classroom, and from what we understand, without saying anything, armed with a large caliber revolver, opened fire on his wife. She was killed in that exchange. There are two students in the classroom that were behind the teacher that were struck by gunfire. One of those children is identified as Jonathan Martinez, common spelling. He's 8 years old. He was taken to Loma Linda University Medical Center via helicopter, airlifted out almost immediately as soon as we can get resources there. Tragically, he has passed away.
A new investigation by Global Witness has revealed oil giant Shell knowingly participated in a massive bribery scheme that ended up robbing Nigerians of more than $1 billion. In 2011, Shell, an Italian oil company, Eni, paid a combined $1.1 billion for access to a massive offshore oil block. Newly revealed internal emails show Shell executives knew the money would be stolen by Nigeria's former oil minister, a convicted money launderer who used the stolen money to bribe government officials and to buy a private jet, armored cars, and firearms. Shell has long denied knowing anything about the corruption involved in the deal. In Charleston, South Carolina, convicted murderer and white supremacist Dylan Roof pleaded guilty to 9 counts of murder in state court on Monday. Roof has already been convicted and sentenced to death on federal charges of murdering 9 black worshipers, including Pastor Clementa Pinckney, at the historic Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston in June of 2015. A Houston District Court judge has ruled Texas's 2011 voter ID law was written with a specific intent to suppress the votes of African-American and Latino voters, residents. This is now the 5th time a judge has ruled that Texas voter ID law is discriminatory. The law created a list of IDs required to vote that skewed heavily toward IDs carried by whites, such as concealed carry permits, while excluding IDs often carried by people of color, such as government employee IDs and public university IDs. The ruling comes after the Justice Department dropped part of its legal objection to Texas's strict voter ID law in February, saying it would no longer argue the law had a discriminatory intent. Alabama Governor Robert Bentley resigned Monday as he faced the first day of impeachment hearings over accusations he was having an affair with a senior political adviser, then used public money and resources to try to cover up the relationship. Bentley will be succeeded by Lieutenant Governor Kay Ivey, the second female governor in Alabama's history. Meanwhile, Seattle Mayor Ed Murray is facing multiple accusations he molested and had sex with underage boys in the 1980s. 2 Wells Fargo executives are being forced by the company's board to pay back $75 million in compensation over a massive scandal in which Wells Fargo workers created 2 million fake accounts in order to meet grueling sales targets. Wells Fargo former CEO John Stumpf and the former head of community banking Carrie Tolstedt are forced to return a combined $75 million in pay, making it the largest clawback in U.S. banking history. Wells Fargo has fired a staggering 5,300 low-level workers over the creation of the fake accounts. People nationwide also continue to protest Wells Fargo over its role in funding the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline. United Airlines is facing widespread criticism after video surfaced of a doctor being forcibly dragged off a plane by security officers on Sunday after United overbooked the flight and then demanded some passengers disembark. When no one volunteered, they chose for people to get off the flight. The 69-year-old man was selected to be forced off the plane. He protested, saying he was a doctor who needed to see his patients at a hospital in Kentucky the following morning. The Washington Post reports a fellow passenger says he said more or less, "I'm being selected because I'm Chinese." Multiple Chicago Department of Aviation security officers then began dragging him through the aisle as fellow passengers screamed.
I have to go home. I have to go home. I have to go home. I have to go home.
After being removed, the man, who was bloodied by the first removal, attempted to run back onto the plane. He was then forcibly removed a second time. United Airlines CEO has apologized for, quote, having to reaccommodate these customers, unquote. Some people in China have begun calling for a boycott of United Airlines. The Pulitzers have been announced. The New York Daily News and ProPublica won the top public service journalism award for a joint investigation into the New York Police Department's use of eviction rules to force people of color out of their homes. The Washington Post's David Fahrenthold won for his investigation into how President Trump lied during the campaign about donating millions of dollars to charities to help veterans. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, McClatchy and the Miami Herald, also won for their reporting on the massive Panama Papers leak that revealed how the Panama-based Mossack Fonseca law firm set up a global network of shell companies for heads of state and other elites to store money offshore to avoid taxes and oversight. Art Cullen of the tiny family-run newspaper The Storm Lake Iowa Times won for his editorials that challenged the corporate agriculture industry, including the Koch brothers, Cargill and Monsanto. Cullen is not only the paper's editorial writer, but also the paper's editor and part-time reporter. His brother John is the paper's publisher. The Pulitzer Prize for Biography went to Hisham Attar for The Return, Fathers, Sons, and the Land in Between, which chronicles the author's return to Libya, where his father had been imprisoned by Muammar Gaddafi 2 decades earlier. And the Pulitzer Prize for History went to Heather Ann Thompson for Blood in the Water, the Attica prison uprising of 1971 and its legacy. This is Thompson speaking on Democracy Now! About her investigation into the decades-long cover-up about how armed state troopers raided the prison to break the standoff, firing more than 2,000 rounds of ammunition, killing 29 prisoners and 10 guards.
For 45 years, the majority of the records for Attica remain sealed by the state attorney general's office, or at least very difficult to get. And the reason is that for all of the death at Attica, no member of law enforcement was ever held responsible. So the book was the journey to figure out who had created so much trauma, what had happened in the governor's office to lead to this retaking, who were the members of law enforcement that not only shot their weapons, but indeed the highest levels of the state police who worked very hard to tamper with evidence, to conceal evidence, and to protect their own. And that was a key journey for finding out that information.
And Lynn Nottage also won for her drama Sweat. To see our full interview with Heather Ann Thompson, as well as with Hisham Attar and Michael Hudson, senior editor at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, you can go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Funerals have begun in Egypt for victims of 2 bomb attacks targeting Coptic Christian churches on Sunday. At least 49 people were killed and over 100 were injured. ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attacks, which targeted the St. George's Coptic Church in the northern city of Tanta and the St. Mark's Cathedral in the northern city of Alexandria, where Coptic Pope Tewodros was celebrating Palm Sunday Mass. The Pope was uninjured in the attack.
One of the Coptic parishioners who survived the attack in Tanta described what happened.
It was a little after 9 a.m. The prayers were being held and everyone was sitting in their places, but the pews weren't full yet. I was sitting in the front and all of a sudden everything went dark. I passed out and someone pushed me off my seat. A few seconds later, I got up and I saw bodies all around me. I climbed onto the pews and got out using a side door. Then I heard screams. I heard people saying, "Get out."
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi responded by declaring a 3-month state of emergency.
Several steps are to be taken, the first of which will be the declaration of a state of emergency after the necessary legal and constitutional procedures are complete for 3 months in Egypt. We are announcing this state of emergency only to protect our country and secure it and prevent any interference with it.
The state of emergency gives al-Sisi's government even further power to continue its crackdown against human rights activists and journalists. It allows the government and its security forces to surveil all communications, confiscate property, arrest anyone suspected of violating the state of emergency laws, and shut down media outlets. On Monday, Egyptian authorities blocked distribution of the newspaper Al-Bawaba because it included an article blaming the Interior Ministry for security lapses in the church bombings.
To talk more about the situation, we go to Cairo, Egypt, to speak with Democracy Now! Correspondent Sharif Abdo-Kadous, who's also a Nation Institute fellow. Sharif, can you talk about what happened and then the state of emergency in response?
Well, this seems to be, as you mentioned, a security failure in Egypt. I mean, the Islamic State group back in December had signaled its intention to escalate attacks on the Christian minority in Egypt with a bombing in a church in Cairo. It issued a video in January saying it was going to attack Christians. Hundreds of Christians were forced to flee their homes in northern Sinai following a campaign of assassination and intimidation against them. And then on this Palm Sunday, one of the most important religious celebrations for Coptic Christians, we had this coordinated wave of attacks. And it really speaks to a failure of the government's highly powerful intelligence agencies for not anticipating these kinds of attacks. Less than 2 weeks ago, there was a bomb found in the very same church in Tanta that was bombed on Palm Sunday. It was disarmed, but clearly this church was a target. And despite that, the bomber managed to evade security measures, get by a metal detector, walk into the church and blow himself up right near the altar where families were celebrating Palm Sunday. So this really sent shockwaves through Egypt, and it was the deadliest day of violence that Egyptian Christians have seen in many decades.
And Sharif, of Egypt's 90 million people, about 10% are Christians. Generally speaking, are the Coptic Christians seen as supportive of the al-Sisi regime or not?
Well, certainly the Coptic leadership was. The Pope sat next to Abdel Fattah al-Sisi on July 3, 2013, when he ousted Mohamed Morsi. Coptic members of parliament and prominent figures have all been very supportive of it. There was a real threat that the Coptic community saw from the Muslim Brotherhood, which, to its discredit, engaged in a lot of sectarian language to cater to its far-right elements in its constituency. And so they saw the military as coming in as saving them from that. I think it's also very important to note that there is widespread and everyday discrimination against Coptic Christians in Egypt, both legal and social. So, for example, when there's religious clashes or when Coptic homes are burnt down in Upper Egypt, authorities will hold a traditional gathering instead of taking the perpetrators to court to shield them from prosecution. Churches have been attacked for years under the pretext that they're built or renovated illegally. Then we have years of debate, and finally Parliament passed a law last year passed a law about renovating churches that still is far more restrictive than the regulations allowing mosques to be built. So, and there's also a failure to even acknowledge this kind of discrimination. Officials usually say it's exaggerated or even non-existent, and this creates fertile ground for those who seek to incite violence against Christians like the Islamic State.
And Sharif, I wanted to ask you also, have there been any efforts by the or any successful attempts by the secular pro-democracy movement in Egypt, which is obviously now under intense attack by the al-Sisi government, as well as the supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood, to attempt to build some kind of alliance because really al-Sisi is consolidating further and further his dictatorship. And I'm wondering what the popular efforts to build a united front against him, if there's any real effort occurring.
Well, so many groups are under such fierce attack right now. There really is organizing and movement building is very difficult at the moment. So many people have been imprisoned. So many people have gone into exile because of the repression in Egypt. Civil society is under an unprecedented attack. So it's very hard for people to get together. It's also very dangerous to try and organize in a real way. So I think we're seeing, although you do see pockets of resistance that rise up. There was a case about two islands that that Egypt gave to Saudi Arabia sovereignty over, and there was a massive protest about that and a favorable court ruling that was recently overturned. Doctors came out in full force after some of members of their syndicate were attacked by police, and that had an effect in the courts as well. So you do see these moments of uprising, but in terms of cohesive movement building, I think we're still a long way off.
Following Sunday's attack, President Trump took to Twitter to express his faith in Sisi, tweeting, quote, "So sad to hear of the terrorist attack in Egypt. U.S. strongly condemns. I have great confidence that President al-Sisi will handle situation properly." Sharif, can you talk about the special relationship between Sisi? He was the first foreign leader to call and congratulate Donald Trump. He just was received by Donald Trump at the White House. And also the history of the security crackdown, emergency rule under Mubarak, it lasted for over three decades.
Right. I mean, Egypt lived under a state of emergency for all 30 years of Mubarak's rule. The lifting of the state of emergency was one of the main demands of the 2011 uprising. It was finally lifted in 2012, reinstated briefly for a month following the massacre in Rabaa in 2013. But what the state of emergency that Sisi ordered on Sunday does, it grants him exceptional powers, for example, to use state security emergency courts to try suspects. These are courts where the verdicts cannot be appealed by any other court, where the president can appoint army officers to sit on the judicial panel. It also gives him the right to impose curfews, to greater rights to impose censorship. It gives broader authority to the army to have jurisdiction that is usually reserved for law enforcement, so they can arrest people on the streets. And he also announced the establishment of a new, powerful new body called the Supreme Council to Combat Terrorism and Extremism that will regulate the media and religious discourse and so on. We have yet to see what its remit will really be. Having said all that, it's difficult to know what exactly will change on the ground. We have to remember security forces in Egypt act with complete impunity and with really no restrictions governed by the law. Forced disappearances are rampant. Arbitrary detention is rampant. People are held in detention under what's called preventative detention or provisional detention for weeks or months or years without ever going to trial. So it's hard to know how much worse it can get, although it can always get worse. And finally, the state of emergency, there has been a state of emergency in northern Sinai on a near continuous basis for the past 3 years. And despite that, there is an insurgency that's raging with daily combat between militants and the security forces. So I doubt that these measures will really have an effect on this increasing militant violence that we're seeing in Egypt.
Special relationship?
Right. Well, Trump and Sisi have fomented a very close relationship, you know, devoid of any kind of criticism of each other. But this, in one way, it could be dangerous that it further emboldens Sisi to crack down even further without even the kind of muted criticism that we heard from previous administrations. But we have to also remember that U.S. policy has changed very little for the past four decades, which is complete support for successive Egyptian regimes, complete military funding and backing and diplomatic support for the government that continued from Reagan through Bush, through Obama, and it's continuing under Trump, although the rhetoric is very different. And there's, he went almost beyond diplomatic protocol yesterday, calling, not only voicing concern or condolences for the victims, but re-expressing how Sisi, he has all confidence that Sisi will win this war on terror. And we have to remember that Sisi, his central promise of coming to power was to crush terrorism and to restore security. And so these attacks really undermine his credibility. And we already saw during his speech where he announced a state of emergency, he criticized local media for their coverage of the attacks. And we saw right after the speech finished, all footage of the victims of the attacks was disappeared from local TV channels. And as you mentioned, we also saw him, authorities pull from the printing presses a newspaper that is run by a staunch pro-Sisi supporter that pointed to security failure as the reason for behind the attacks. So they're very much concerned that his image as being strong on national security will be damaged by these attacks.
Sharif, we want to thank you for being with us and be safe. Sharif Abdelkaddous, Democracy Now's correspondent in Cairo, a Nation Institute fellow. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. Winds and Shadows by Dafar Youssef. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, we turn now to look at how Attorney General Jeff Sessions is attempting to shake up policing in the country by limiting federal oversight of police departments with a history of civil rights violations while calling for an escalation of the war on drugs. Last week, Sessions ordered a wide-ranging review of the federal government, of the federal consent decrees with local law enforcement agencies that have been accused of brutality and violating civil rights laws. The review signals the Justice Department intends to shift away from monitoring and forcing changes within police departments, such as the Police Department of Ferguson, Missouri, where systematic racial discrimination by the police and the police killing of an unarmed 18-year-old African-American Michael Brown sparked an uprising in 2014.
This comes after Attorney General Jeff Sessions openly expressed concerns about efforts at police reform in a recent speech.
Unfortunately, in recent years, law enforcement as a whole, I think, has been unfairly maligned and blamed for unacceptable deeds of a few bad actors. You've got some 800,000 state and local law officers and federal officers in America. Imagine a city of 800,000. Are you not going to have people who make mistakes, people who commit crimes out of that group? And so we're not perfect. We all know that. Department of Justice is going to fulfill its role to ensure that law enforcement officers are not out of control. And if they violate the law, they will be punished. But we've got to be careful about what we're doing. We cannot malign entire departments. Too many of our officers, deputies, and troopers believe the political leadership in this country has abandoned them. I like that line from Pirates of Penzance. I think Gilbert and Stuart Olin says, when constabulary duties are to be done, the policeman's lot is not a happy one. You know, it's no fun to go out and hammer somebody and see them go to jail. Nobody likes to do that. But it's our duty. It's our lot.
During this same speech in Richmond, Virginia, Attorney General Jeff Sessions called for what many see as a new war on drugs.
We need to say, as Nancy Reagan said, just say no. Don't do it. My nation needs to say clearly once again that using drugs is bad. It will destroy your life. In the 80s and 90s, we saw campaigns stressing prevention. We can do this again. Educating people and telling them the terrible truth about drugs and addiction will result in better choices by more people. We can reduce the use of drugs, save lives, and turn back the surge in crime that inevitably falls in the wake of increased drug use.
For more, we're joined by two guests, Sherrilyn Ifill, President and Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and Norm Stamper, former chief of the Seattle Police Department and the author of the book To Protect and to Serve, How to Fix America's Police. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Sherrilyn, let's begin with you. Is this a new war on drugs, and can you talk about the judge's decision?
Well, what we see with Attorney General Jeff Sessions is an effort to basically take us back in time. And you heard, you know, in the clip that you just posted, I mean, he talks about Nancy Reagan. I mean, this is a person who's stuck in the 80s and in some instances stuck in the 50s. And so it's not just about the war on drugs. It's a kind of a retro view of law enforcement and policing in which he's attempting to wipe out the last 30 years of progress in this country to the extent that it's been made. The last 4 years in particular, where we've really been focused on the issue of policing reform, and you talked about Ferguson and the uprising and what's happened, this intense look at unconstitutional policing, this is what Jeff Sessions doesn't want to deal with. He talks about a few bad apples. He's not interested in looking at issues of systemic problems in the police department. But, you know, the statute that governs these investigations and consent decrees, like in Baltimore, is called the Law Enforcement Misconduct Statute, 42 U.S.C. 14141. It was enacted actually as part of the 1994 crime bill as a result of the Rodney King assault and the acquittal of those officers in the first trial. That's a statute that authorizes the attorney general to investigate unconstitutional policing, to engage in these consent decrees. So to the extent that he's a law and order attorney general, this is a law he's willing to completely ignore. In Baltimore, what he's attempted to do is essentially to undermine a consent decree that had been entered in January, had been negotiated over the course of 6 months by the city of Baltimore and by the Department of Justice. As soon as he came into office, Jeff Sessions immediately tried to begin slow-walking approval of consent decree. Even up to last week, the day before there was to be a public hearing, when the community was to come before the federal judge and explain to him what they wanted to see in the consent decree, Jeff Sessions filed a motion asking for a 90-day extension for the judge to review the decree. The judge approved the decree, and even then, Jeff Sessions released a statement essentially criticizing the decree, saying he thinks it will make people in Baltimore less safe. We tried to intervene in the case because we believe the Department of Justice under Jeff Sessions has no intention of fully enforcing the decree. The judge did not allow us to intervene, basically said it's too early, that he assumes that the Department of Justice will enforce the decree. I hope he's right. I think we have enough reason to believe that Jeff Sessions has no intention of actually enforcing the consent decree that really will bring about transformative policing in Baltimore City. People in Baltimore have been waiting for this for years.
I don't think I've ever seen, certainly not in my memory and in the memory of most people, such a complete about-face of a federal institution versus what the policy was in December and November of last year to what it is now. And the impact on so many of these cities that already have these decrees in terms of the fact that the Justice Department has a responsibility to enforce them. I'm wondering what you're thinking, what's going to happen.
It's actually quite astonishing. I mean, he ordered this review of a 14 consent decree. So we're talking about Ferguson, we're talking about Cleveland, we're talking about places all over the country in which police departments themselves have gotten on board with the idea of transformation. You know, I when I met with Jeff Sessions and I met with him, I said to him, do you actually talk to local police? Because the chief of police in Baltimore will tell you out of his mouth, he wants the consent decree. Even the head of the FOP said at their most recent labor summit in Las Vegas, the Fraternal Order of Police, said consent decrees bring resources to police departments. If you talk to police chiefs, we work with the International Association of Chiefs of Police. They know that this is a moment when reform has to happen, that there does have to be 21st century policing. And so I question Jeff Sessions. I understand you have your own views, but do you talk to police? The man who was who was just confirmed as Jeff Sessions' deputy, Rod Rosenstein. He's the former U.S. attorney from Baltimore. Just a week before I met with Attorney General Sessions, had indicted seven Baltimore police officers for racketeering from the elite gun unit, police officers who were shaking down residents of the community. I told this to Jeff Sessions. He's got his own worldview, and he came in with that worldview, and no fact is going to shake that view.
What did Sessions say to you? What did he respond?
Well, besides calling me articulate, he essentially said, well, maybe Baltimore had some problems. But as you can see, it had no effect on him because he's come forward with an effort to try to scuttle the decree.
Yeah, I want to ask Norm Stamper, you were the head of the Seattle Police Department. Seattle is under a consent decree which has had enormous progress for the city's policing. Could you talk about that?
Tremendous progress. As a matter of fact, last week, the federally appointed monitor of the consent decree in Seattle wrote essentially a love letter to the city, civic officials, the police chief, and he named the rank and file as well and said, this is a department that is undergoing major transformation. 5 years ago, that was not the case. 5 years ago, the allegations of excessive force and biased policing were well established. So what's happened? There's been a 60% reduction in use of force by Seattle police officers. There has been a dramatic decrease in the use of firearms, tasers, and batons. And police officers themselves, through the president of the Police Officers Guild, are saying the train has left the station. We're grateful that we're at this stage of our progress.
And the crime rate has continued to go down,
The crime rate has continued to go down. Officer injuries are either flat or dropping. So there's been no so-called Ferguson effect or de-policing.
Well, let's go back to Attorney General Jeff Sessions speaking to police and federal officials last month in Richmond, Virginia.
Many of you who are law enforcement leaders have told us that in this age of viral videos and targeted killings of police, something has changed in policing. Some law enforcement personnel are more reluctant to get out of their squad cars and do the proactive, up-close police work that builds trust and prevents violent crimes and saves lives of innocent people. In some cities, arrests have fallen as murder rates have surged.
So that's Attorney General Jeff Sessions, former Seattle Police Chief Norm Stamper. Your response?
My response to that is he's clearly in lockstep with his boss, the president. He is clearly an apologist for the worst kind of policing in this country. He is pandering to police unions. He is saying things that he thinks they want to hear.
But Charlin's even saying that the police union is saying that they want to continue
these. That's happened in Baltimore. It's happened in Seattle. He needs to visit those two cities and pay attention. Instead of mouthing slogans, he needs to sit down and listen to the officers themselves.
Charlin, I wanted to ask you about this whole issue of his emphasis now on drugs as well, because clearly not only is that out of step, but it's out of step with the reality of how drugs are spreading in the country today. The drug problem in America today is in rural areas. It's opioids and it's heroin. It's not as much in the inner city as it used to be. Is he going to now oversee the breaking down of doors and the a huge increase in law enforcement activities in the rural areas of America against white people who are now on drugs?
I'm going to guess no. But what I am going to say is that this is, again, about kind of being in that time machine. And this is really the tragic consequence, I think, of this policy. The policy that Jeff Sessions is advancing actually, as you say, has nothing to do with the way in which the drug problem manifests itself in our country today. And what he's suggesting as a solution will not meet the problem. And so even as, you know, while the president was campaigning, he talked about, you know, a drug addiction and as talked about the need to deal with drug addiction. The policy that Jeff Sessions is suggesting actually won't reach the opioid epidemic. Not only will it not reach the opioid epidemic because it focuses on law enforcement rather than treatment, but because it also kind of thinks that there's this simplistic just say no. You heard him refer to Nancy Reagan, just say no way in which we're going to deal with the drug problem. Everyone now knows that the way in which we dealt with the drug problem in the 80s and the 90s was very much racially biased, very much did not meet the problem, didn't deal with the issue of education, didn't deal with the issue of treatment, and didn't deal with the issue of the underlying conditions in communities that create and make people vulnerable to the drug problem. And so what Jeff Sessions is suggesting is something that just simply won't meet the problem. What he's hoping to do is to change the narrative in this country. You know, we just heard the train has left the station in terms of law enforcement. The train's also left the station in terms of thinking about drug addiction. And what he's trying to do is shift and turn the narrative back. And that's why we've got to resist this. I think most people in the country actually recognize that we can't go backwards in policing and we can't go backwards in those kinds of drug policies. The question is, will we allow Jeff Sessions, particularly will police departments, if he offers them, you know, funds and money and resources, allow themselves to be sucked back into something that they know does not work? When you look at the crime problem in places like Baltimore and Chicago, part of it has to do with the lack of trust of the community because of unconstitutional policing. People aren't calling the police to tell them information about crimes. They're not standing with the police as a community must if you're really to solve crime problems. They know that part of the way you reduce crime is you build trust between the relationship and the police. And the way you build that trust is that police officers have to begin by ending unconstitutional policing, showing respect for the community, and engaging in sound law enforcement policies.
I want to turn to a Facebook video posted by the Lake County Sheriff's Department in Florida. In the video, Sheriff Peyton Grinnell stands surrounded by four masked men wearing Sheriff's Department uniforms and Kevlar vests.
To the dealers that are pushing this poison, I have a message for you. We're coming for you. As a matter of fact, our undercover agents have already bought heroin from many of you. We are simply awaiting the arrest warrants to be finalized. So, to the dealers, I say, enjoy looking over your shoulder, constantly wondering if today's the day we come for you. Enjoy trying to sleep tonight, wondering if tonight's the night our SWAT team blows your front door off the hinges. We are coming for you. If our agents can show the nexus between you, the pusher of poison, and the person that overdoses and dies, we will charge you with murder. We are coming for you. Run.
Part of a video posted by the Lake County Sheriff's Department in Florida on Facebook. The video has now been viewed on Facebook over a million times. People have compared the image of the sheriff with the men behind him with their heads covered to ISIS. Mm-hmm. Charlotte Eiffel.
I can't imagine how he thinks that that might be effective. First of all, that he thinks people who deal drugs are actually watching Facebook videos of him. This performance was meant not for actually people who are involved in the illegal drug trade. It was actually meant for members of the law-abiding community to reassure them, to make them feel that there's this massive force out there that's going to protect them. And, you know, everything that we see in that video is a setup for unconstitutional policing. You know, we're going to blow the hinges off your doors. We've looked at the cases in which, you know, SWAT teams have made these terrible mistakes, have blown the hinges off the wrong door, and resulted in the death of children and others as they enter people's homes. So once again, that's the community.
We're seeing that with ICE as well.
This is exactly, and ICE is part of this. And don't forget that this is part of what Attorney General Sessions wants. He wants to be able to deputize through their 287G program local police departments to increasingly participate in ICE raids. This is what I mean about offering resources to police departments to be part of this agenda. This is what we have to be paying attention to, and that's why there has to be movement and monitoring on the ground in local communities of what their police departments are trying to do.
I'd like to ask Norm Stamper, what about this issue of the SWAT teams like this? And the New York Times did a series about SWAT team raids around the country. Your sense of the militarization of the police and this approach to policing, the impact it has on communities?
We have certainly seen a heightening of the militaristic mentality in law enforcement. It's fueled by the drug war, of course, which has been a colossal failure on every front. And in the aftermath of 9/11, this interest in Homeland Security is manifest by the federal government providing military surplus, MRAPs and automatic weapons, semi-automatic weapons and so forth, to law enforcement. Well, if you have those tools, some call them boys with toys, if you've got those tools, you want to use them. And so they manufacture reasons to conduct those pre-dawn raids in which so many innocent people have been shot and killed. Police officers have been caught in the line of fire as well. What I just saw in that video was an embarrassment to law enforcement.
You had the story in Chicago on March 28th of ICE, an agent with Immigration Customs Enforcement, shooting and injuring 53-year-old Felix Torres after the agents burst into the family's house. His daughter, Carmen, says the family was sleeping when agents burst through the door. She said, they came in, pointed pistols in our faces, dragged us out. We didn't even have time to dress or grab milk for the baby. Felix Torres was hospitalized in serious condition after the ICE shooting, and then ICE said, oh, he wasn't the man we were looking for. We went to the wrong house.
This is what I think Attorney General Sessions will unleash on this country if we are not vigilant and if we are not seriously resistant to this. His theory that there are few bad apples in police departments is an interesting one. Even if he were right that there were not systemic problems and that there are a few bad apples, what he's doing is giving license to the bad apples. He's saying, go out there and be cowboys and do whatever you want to do. And there are going to be lots of people who are hurt by this.
We have to get both of your comments to what happened on United Airlines. It is just so astounding. And the models for policing that are extending throughout the different police forces. People may have seen this on TV. United Airlines facing widespread criticism after video surfaced of a doctor being forcibly dragged off a plane by security officers on Sunday. After United overbooked the flight, they said, would anyone volunteer to be rebooked? No one did. And so then what they claimed is they randomly chose four people. The flight was leaving from Chicago O'Hare International Airport, headed to Louisville, when no one volunteered to get off the flight. The 69-year-old man, the doctor, was selected to be forced off the plane. He said no, he couldn't go. He was a doctor who needed to see his patients in a hospital in Kentucky the following morning. The Washington Post reports a fellow passenger says he said more or less, I'm being selected because I'm Chinese. Multiple Chicago Department of Aviation security officers dragged him through the aisle as fellow passengers screamed. After being removed, the doctor, who was bloodied by the first removal, attempted to run back onto the plane. He was then forcibly removed a second time. Now the United Airlines CEO has apologized for, quote, having to reaccommodate these customers, unquote. I mean, this is an astounding story. They were actually asking four people to leave and then drag this doctor off to replace them with four United Airlines employees. First, Norm Stamper, you're the former police chief of Seattle. This is a different department that's in charge of the airlines.
Well, we're looking at airline security people. One can reasonably question what kind of temperament, what kind of training, what kind of policies guide their work. I think, needless to say, this is a public relations disaster for a major corporation. But it also raises the question of how we deal with people under difficult circumstances, when there is tension, when there is conflict. And I'll go back to the Seattle consent decree. The police officers themselves are saying, I've never had better training, referring to de-escalation training, crisis intervention training in my entire career, helping them on the home front, dealing with their own families, their children, their spouse, that sort of thing. So here we have some people who are probably not well trained in what they have been asked to do, and they're doing it very, very badly.
I can't remember the word they use, the airlines, something like forcible deboarding. He had a paid ticket. Is the idea that all United Airlines customers will now—I mean, I was just in a plane yesterday when they say, would anyone volunteer? Everyone's going to raise their hand because they don't want to be bloodied and perhaps knocked unconscious.
You know, Amy, this is kind of the convergence of two issues. At the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, we've been working on the issue of removals of passengers, not violent removals of passengers, but removals of passengers because other passengers think that they look suspicious or for some other reason. We've been looking at just the issue of racial profiling and the issue of removals. Now we're seeing we go to this kind of very violent removal And what worries me about this is that even if we want to talk about the training of those police officers, the response of United Airlines is so bizarre, in my view, that it suggests that there is a wider and deeper systemic problem. And I worry as, you know, Americans increasingly are being subjected to seeing things like people violently dragged by police officers next to them as they have out cell phone videos. This is almost like the police killings. We're being almost kind of inured to this violence that we're seeing, you know, every place we go. This is in an airplane, and people are witnessing this. This is becoming part of American life. And that's why I say if we don't really get serious and turn against this, we will find that this becomes regularized around us. For a while, people were shocked by the cell phone videos of police killings and people, the police shooting people in the back. Now we're seeing this kind of thing. This is why we have to stand against this attempt to kind of return us to this kind of ultra-violent policing in this country.
Before we go, Sherilyn, I wanted to offer our condolences on the death of your cousin and share her words. The award-winning journalist, the legendary news anchor Gwen Ifill, she died of cancer in November at the age of 61. This is Gwen speaking in 2015 at the Aspen Ideas Festival about the issue of American identity.
I was born of immigrants who came to this country from the West Indies. I had an incredible appreciation for people who thought it was, who did the bold act of uprooting themselves from everything they knew in order to make a better life for their children. We were the, like Michelle's father, craziest patriots on the block. It never occurred to us that we weren't American. In fact, we had chosen to become Americans, which seemed like a very empowering thing. But as in my current role, as I report day after day after day, all of our shortcomings in America, our shortcomings as Americans, I struggle, not with my patriotism or my love of the country, but to figure out how can we get over the humps, not the conversations, not the roundtables, but how do we see each other? How do we begin to see ourselves and then see each other? It's so hard.
So that was Gwen Ifill. Sherilyn, your remarkable cousin.
Yes, she is remarkable. Was remarkable. I've never seen that clip, but that's her.
Well,
thank you.
Well, thank you for sharing her with all of us. Sherilyn Ifill, NAACP, Legal Defense Fund, head of it. Norm Stamper, former chief, Seattle Police Department. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, does President Trump personally profit off of airstrikes like the one in Syria, the Tomahawk cruise missiles? What's his connection? Stay with us. Red Eyes by the War on Drugs. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, on Friday, the stock price of the military contractor Raytheon briefly surged after the U.S. attack on a Syrian airbase, which used 59 of the company's Tomahawk missiles, estimated to cost $1.4 million apiece. While the stock surge was brief, it called attention to the fact that President Trump himself has held personally invested in Raytheon in the past. A 2015 Federal Election Committee disclosure filed when Trump launched his presidential bid reveals that he held Raytheon stocks worth $1,000 to $15,000 in value.
While the value is low, the revelations have raised additional questions about the lack of transparency in Trump's financial holdings and the fact that he could potentially benefit from almost any military decision he makes as president. Overall, the stocks of military contractors such as Boeing and General Dynamics have increased since Trump's election, further fueled by his promise of an historic tens of billions of dollars increase in U.S. military spending. For more, we're joined by Bill Hartung. He's the director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. Latest book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. William Hartung, welcome back to Democracy Now! So tell us, as those Tomahawk cruise missiles were pummeling this base, though not enough to take it out, it was immediately in use again. How did President Trump profit personally?
Well, as far as we know, he may still have shares in Raytheon, as reported in his financial disclosure. Of course, as with all things Trump, there's a black box here because he's not reporting his tax returns. He hasn't done a blind trust. As you said, virtually anything he does, not just in the military sphere, could benefit him, his family, his inner circle financially. And the only way to deal with that is release the tax returns that people have demanded and have a true blind trust that's not run by his family. But it's no question it's an outrage to have the commander-in-chief profiting from a military contract in the middle of a conflict, however small the amount may be. And the fact that he's not willing to disclose his current position in some ways makes it even worse.
I wanted to ask you in terms of this, the emphasis on military action that's emerging in the first few weeks of the Trump administration. You wrote a piece for Tom Dispatch titled, Could War with Iran Be on Washington's Agenda? Could you talk about that?
Sure. Well, there's this sort of notion that, you know, the adults in the room are Mattis and McMaster, who are, you know, military people. They'll be careful. They know the costs of war. But they're also among the most hawkish generals of their generation. Mattis himself wanted to attack Iran during the Iraq War, which is one of the reasons.
This is Mad Dog Mattis.
Yes, exactly.
Self-described.
Is his self-described moniker. And he, you know, in the middle of that war, actually left the administration because he wanted to attack them at the very same time they were negotiating to limit Iran's nuclear options. So they've already stepped up in Yemen, more special forces, more airstrikes. They're still arming the Saudis, who are killing thousands with civilian bombings. So they see that as a strike against Iran. Of course, Iran is not the problem there, but their worldview says it is. And now the step up in Syria, of course, Iran is allies with Assad. So it's another kind of potential strike at Iranian concerns. Now, the question is, will they go further? And I think there, you know, Iran would have many ways to respond through non-state actors, through missile strikes. It's not a small country. You know, invading Iran would make the Iraq War look like a walk in the park. So how are these military people going to address this? But there's certainly a danger of some sort of military action. And, of course, they're not going to telegraph it. I mean, Trump apparently decided this on rather short notice, if we're to believe the accounts. He saw something on TV and he got exercised.
You've got the advertisements on television and then the news being an advertisement as well for these weapons contractors. Let's turn to MSNBC's Brian Williams, the night of the Tomahawk cruise missile attack.
Go into greater detail. We see these beautiful pictures at night from the decks of these two U.S. Navy vessels in the Eastern Mediterranean. I am tempted to quote the great Leonard Cohen, I'm guided by the beauty of our weapons. And they are beautiful pictures of fearsome armaments making what is for them a brief flight over to this airfield. What did they hit?
I dare say Leonard Cohen might be rolling over in his grave and not rock and rolling. Bill Hartung.
Well, you know, obviously it's obscene to worship weaponry, whoever it's targeted at. And on Raytheon's webpage, where they're advertising the cruise missile, they have exactly the same kind of pictures. So to have them on MSNBC and CNN is all the publicity money could buy and more. And, of course, this has happened before in wartime, even in the first Persian Gulf War under Bush the Elder, where these kinds of displays have upped the images of these companies and almost made the weapons seem benign. There's all these things about how accurate they are and how they're going to hit civilians, which has been disproved almost uniformly in the history of U.S. intervention in the Middle East. So there's that. And also it's a question of how it's going to affect Trump's push for his military buildup, because he's going to sort of posture as the wartime president. You know, as Fareed Zakaria said, much to his detriment, he's now the president. He's proved he's the president because he can launch a military strike, which, again, to me, is not what this country should stand for.
Bill Hartung, thank you for being with us, director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. That does it for our broadcast. I'll be in Cambridge, Massachusetts on April 24th and 25th, and moving on to Vermont, from Burlington to Montpelier, from Middlebury to Brattleboro. Check our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Gesder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wilsler, Agata Dino, Sam Malkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Sharina Nadura, Andre Lewis. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.